Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are helping the good people win the rhetoric wars. Got to beat the bad people. They're too—they're getting too much ground, too much linguistic ground. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. So let's learn a little bit about rhetoric. What do you say? I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor. If I was in Germany, I'd be Herr Doctor Professor, but no such luck. Now I'm just a guy who used to teach college. Also a late night comedy writer, longtime stand-up, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, spreading the word. And I have people on here each week. I have comedians on. I explore their politics. I have conservatives on. I try to convert them away from their heinous beliefs. And I also have professional persuaders on here, and we try to learn some things from them. This week, I think the last two categories apply to this guy. No, not conservative, the first and third category. So comedian, and he's got some ideas. My guest this week is somebody I met a long time ago in the stand-up minds. I think we worked at the Funny Farm together. I think.
That's what you were saying when you sent me that. I guess it was on Facebook. Was it on Facebook?
A little Facebook message. One way or the other, we passed each other with our joke miner hats on in the dark caves of stand-up comedy.
That condo was the dark cave.
Yeah, there's plenty of dark caves in stand-up. But I always remember thinking, the first time I watched you on stage, wow, that's actually some smart stand-up. And it was one of the first times, you know, I'd seen like actual intelligence. Like there's a lot of, you know, smart stand-up, but there's intelligent stand-up, and you were in there. And so I was always impressed by that.
Yeah. You know, Jonathan Katz.
Who?
Jonathan Katz.
I know him from the cartoon.
Yeah. Jonathan used to have a great joke. He goes, it's a blessing and it's a curse. It's a blurs. You know?
Yeah. That sounds about right.
That's the last things you want to hear. The word, honey, let's go see. They said that they got an intelligent comic at the club tonight. Let's go see that.
Yeah, it's such a big selling point. I used to love it when they would tell people I was a professor. Oh. I'm like, yeah, that's great. I'm working at a Florida biker bar. Please mention that. So
that actually gives you credibility.
In a way, it also makes them hate you. Like they immediately, you know, they immediately.
No, I mean, the fact that you worked at a Florida biker bar gives you credibility. I didn't mean the professor thing is like, oh, great. That's what the world needs. An academic who thinks he's funny.
Yeah, there's plenty of those. So my guest this week is Chris Bliss. He's a, I'm going to do a quick, I don't know, master juggler, corporate MC, headlining stand-up, early YouTube star, TED talker, and I'm going to label you a constitutional activist in a good way. That's a lot to juggle, Chris. It's a lot to juggle.
Well, at least you got the juggling joke out of the way right up front. Incidentally, it's not an official title, but in some circles I am known as Dr. Bliss. I was known as the joke doctor for a while there. You've done some joke doctoring. You know what I'm talking about.
What a great last name. Is that, what's your real last name?
Dickey. Yeah. So it wasn't like, well, go with this. That was never like, this. It was, you know, I backed into it anyway. I mean, I started the first time I ever did performance. Well, wait a minute. I think I did a Mark Twain thing in high school. I couldn't remember half of the stuff because I made the, during the rehearsals, had not inhaled the cigar, but smoked a whole cigar. And the next day I was so sick, you know, and I think I'd done like, I had lines as Archbishop Cranmer or whatever it is in A Man for All Seasons. But my first stand-up performance, my best friend in high school had a good friend who created a fake band, 50s band, called Sparky and the Plugs.
Okay.
And all the songs were about cars. Okay. And it was the thing. And they needed somebody who looked like Bowser to be their lead vocalist, who already had a character name. And the character's name was Drippy Moon, the man whose voice makes the ladies swoon.
Nice.
Not my writing, not my name, not my writing, not my concept. Stumbled into it when I first started juggling. I went, well, I guess I'm Drippy Moon. So that was my first stage name. I have a story that's even more humiliating than that we can, that we can maybe get to later.
I don't know, man. That's a good, you know, that's a good foundation to start from. Like,
well, as far as that's true. There's only one direction to go. But I was doing that. That's what I was performing as when I was doing the rock, when I started doing the hippie juggling thing, you know, with the rock bands and the, at the coffee house and the midnight movies at Northwestern. And then at a natural foods restaurant in Eugene, Oregon, when I transferred out to the University of Oregon from Northwestern. And on my way out of academia, I went from the dean's list to 6 incompletes my first year at the University of Oregon, and was living in the band house by June as the rock and roll juggler of this really good, really talented band that was playing in the Pacific Northwest. And I would do their breaks. You know, in those days I was drippy mode.
That's fascinating. Like, you literally came in through juggling.
Yeah, I mean, but there was no plan. It was just like, get out of college and any possibility of winding up in my father's law firm. That the plan, I've never known what I wanted to do. I've always known what I absolutely couldn't possibly do.
Right.
And if you, and I've known people who were born to something and they clicked very early on. It's really nice to have that, you know. But if you don't have that, if you have the opposite, where you know what you don't want to do, turn 180 degrees around and run. You know, you go the opposite direction. Dad, I'm quitting college to become a juggler. Bridge burned.
It's a strong, that's a strong life strategy. I use that a lot too. Like, I know what I reject, you know, like
it's not bad, because if that's where you, I mean, go with clarity. I mean, I'm dead serious about this. When you're clear on that, that's good, because it, you know, that you go, okay, I'm not doing that, you know? So that is a good life strategy. And I think, when did I don't remember when I became Chris Bliss. I took this woman's last name for a while because Drippy Moon was like, we were living together and she was really hot. And so I took her last name, which is French, you know, and I made myself Christopher. I won't say her last name, and worked under that for a while. And it was pretty, I've got a falling apart black and white picture of me in 4-inch black cobra skin platform heels with a robe, with a like a theatrical robe thing. And I think it's a gold beret. I was under her control. I would say it was mind control, but it wasn't the mind that was under the control. In other words, I had no natural thing about performance, you know. I mean, it was like, hey, come sing with our stupid band. Oh, that sounds like fun. Hey, you should really do that juggling thing you're doing in the dorm room at the midnight movies or the coffee house we used to have back then, where people were drinking coffee to bring them down off the acid. You know, that's why coffee was big. But there was no plan to it. Then the woman, you know, and kept on, she dressed me. And I mean, I had a rhinestone kind of... I had a white spandex jumpsuit with rhinestones on it, spelled out Bliss when I became Bliss.
That's awesome.
So it wasn't.
Do you know Killer Bees?
You know what? Yeah, so you can't call it mastermind, I don't think.
No, but it's, you know, it's kind of intuitively, you know, working your way through something and seeing an opportunity. There's a certain genius to that.
It's somewhere in between organic and pussy whipped, as far as my evolution.
I think, again, those are pretty strong, pretty clear pathways. Like, you know what's driving you.
You know, I mean, it's not three-dimensional space. It's between here and here. So,
do you know Killer Bees, the Southern comic?
I don't know. I know of him. I don't know him.
Interesting guy, actually. But he had his wife managed him for a while.
She was a ton of energy. He had a what?
His wife was a comedy club waitress, and then they got married. And so she became his manager. Oh, and she started dressing him. And he for a while was doing Armani suits, you know, like these brightly colored Armani suits. And if you know his act, it's like that doesn't quite fit his act. But he walked in once in a completely red Armani suit. And I'm like, hey, man, shut the door behind you. The elves are going to get in. And he was like, fuck you, man. Fuck you. That ain't funny.
Hey, I used to have an agent named Gary Vindels. Did you ever know Vindels?
Uh-uh.
He worked at Spotlight, which was the agency that went up in smoke with a lot of comedians' money. you know, what up in scandal. And then Gary moved and he was on his own and he did some nice things for me. He got me into Montreal. He got me on the Tonight Show, you know? So, but we're in Montreal together and Gary was a dresser like that. Only they weren't Armani. They were just this, you know, and he's in this bright green jacket, you know, in Montreal, right? This, I mean, bright, I mean, Kermit the Frog green.
I love and that. Instead, like that.
You know, so, and Rich Jenny walks in and goes, oh, hi, Gary. Nice to see you. Say, I didn't know you won the Masters. I could have thought of that. But
hilarious. Rich Jenny's one of those guys that it makes me sad that everybody doesn't know who he is. You know, he was such a great stand-up. But he never really could get into TV.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was another one of those guys you say like Schubert, bulletproof on stage.
Yeah.
You know? But I remember asking him once, I said, because I was just starting to do corporates and I working somewhere. I said, hey, Rich, do you ever not work? Does it ever not work at a corporate? Says, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Jake Johansson told me a story once about corporates. You're going to love this. I said, Jake, because I was asking people, because it's like, is this important? It's a different, it's a whole weird thing where, you know, good comics probably don't belong. And so I said, Jake, you ever have corporate? He says, yeah, sometimes they don't. And Jake should work everywhere, you know. I mean, he's got a likability and his writing and everything else. I said, what do you do when it's not working? He said, Chris, I always ask just a comedy app, but I always ask for my deposit check, the rest of my money before I go on stage. He said, I take that check and I put it in the inner pocket of my coat, my jacket. And if it's not going well, and I know I'm not getting out of it, I just tap the check. Remind myself it's there, you know. So he told me this story. I'm telling it to some guy that I do. I've done a couple of corporate dates where he said, "Yeah, I've seen Jake do that." So I didn't know what he was doing, but I saw him up there. I wonder what the hell's that. So it was actually a true story. Well, okay, you know.
Yeah,
you gotta have your. You know, I mean, it's not
have your priorities. You have to know what's important, right? Yeah, laughs are great. Yeah. Checks are even better.
Well, and one of those things that you get to in your career is you get to, it's like, okay, I will do a great gig for shit money. And I will do a shit gig for great money. Just no more shit gigs for shit money. Yeah, talking about where we met. I think that qualified as a shit gig for shit money.
Well, as I used to say, there's a certain stage in stand-up where you just, it's always the audience's fault. Like you may be a little off, but you're not so off that they shouldn't, you know, laugh. Like it's always the audience. Like, you know, it's not you.
Yes, I completely endorse that point of view. I mean, we're in a victim society. We're the victims of bad audiences.
Exactly.
There's you know, it's like jokes are like dogs. There's no bad jokes.
So
just bad audiences.
So cool. So talk about this a little bit. You've had an interesting career. You've like you said, you had the Trippy Moon start.
Drippy, not Trippy. Drippy. Trippy would have been better.
Trippy Moon would have been better.
Drippy with a D. Yeah, I mean, Drippy. I mean, seriously.
It reminds me like the George Carlin hippy dippy weatherman, you know, start. If you look back at old Carlin, it's like, wow, that's how you got in?
Well, I will have to. But it was funny, you know.
Oh, he was always funny. Yeah, but like before that, he was, you know, straight, you know.
He was so mainstream. The Sullivan stuff was so weird to think of him, you know, having to hide in that suit, right? You know. Well, there's no hiding when you're Drippy Moon. Let me tell you that right now. You're out there. Yeah.
You're dripping your moon for everybody. You're right there.
And I will send you Robin Rainbow story later. So just for your personal pleasure.
Okay.
It was the only time in my career that I fell below the clown line.
So what was that like for you? Like I've always had this, you know, dual consciousness about stand-up. Like I'll be on stage and, you know, I pre-write a lot of material, but I got to where it just bores me to just do pre-written jokes. So I just do crowd work for the most part, because at least it's somewhat intellectually interesting, you know, because I don't know what's going to happen. So I'm not just repeating something. I'm not just being an actor. And I've always had this dual consciousness about I like jokes and I love comedy, but I like to actually say things as well. So I try to bake some of that into the stand-up, but it's just a losing cause. Most people are coming out for just, you know, straight entertainment, and they want you to hit that, you know, gong as hard as you can. They don't want you to mix in, you know, a bunch of ideas for the most part.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you're saying the rhetoric warriors and you're going ethical persuasion, right?
Sure.
And in the ethic of comedy, you're right. They're coming to be entertained. You have to do your best at that. But you also have to lead with your strength. I mean, if you've got something, if you, that's the challenge, make what's funny to them. You know, make what's interesting to you funny to them, you know? And you can do that, but for a certain amount of the material, or you get, and then you have to default to the ethical part of it, which is like, okay, I will, or they can't, or the thing doesn't happen. Okay, you came here for entertainment, I'll give you entertainment. I saw Bill Hicks at a great club in Chicago that didn't last very long called the Funny Firm, a beautiful club, right? And Hicks was, I don't remember what night of the week it was, weeknight, probably two-thirds house. And Hicks was doing this material about how the demon seed was spawned. Have you ever heard the material?
Yeah.
About John David, about the devil impregnating John Davidson through his jasmine.
So intricate. Things. What an intricate, horrible. Yeah.
And then he shits the demon brood. And then basically, you know, so it's, I mean, it's a bizarre kind of, but the demon brood is this packaged mediocrity. You know, the demon brood is a list of celebrities, right? Who are just spreading the gospel of their celebrity. You know, and this is what he's talking about, this mediocrity. I mean, it's a multi-level marketing piece for comedy. Comedy, definitely, you know, Hicks at his best. And the audience couldn't go there. They couldn't, that audience that night couldn't get there. And this is Hicks, who people would think, you know, here's a guy who's going to go, it's the audience's fault, or play for the back of the room. He finished the material. And I might be projecting this on him. I didn't know him. I didn't talk to him about it, you know. And then you saw him just kind of, and then he did 10 or 15 minutes of driving across the country in the backseat of the station wagon with his dad and his brothers when he was a kid.
Yeah.
Gold, you know, what do they call it? Evergreen material.
Right.
Delivered completely. And I just thought that it was such a generous thing to do. You know, it's like, okay, I tried to offer you what I thought was, I mean, what I think is really the funniest. I offered it to you, you know, no attitude that it didn't work. Switched to something he knew they would really enjoy to close the show with. I just thought that's ethical.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
You know, there's an ethic in there that's really strong, that it isn't about you when you walk on stage. I don't know how many times this happened to you. Did you ever walk on stage without a sense of humor?
No, it was, I think
I'm
it was
dead
there.
Serious.
You mean like in a bad mood?
Literally without a sense of humor. One of my favorites when I was just working at getting, you know, wasn't that great a stand-up. So, but you know, you do, your favorite clubs are the ones you're always crushing, right? And there was a place called Rooster Tea Feathers. Did you ever play it?
I know what it is, but I never did the
up outside of San Francisco. And I always killed there. And I was really looking forward to playing there, right? But it was the 13th straight week on the road. All right. And I walked up, and this is how bad it was, Dan. They hated the juggling. They didn't just hate every joke, they hated the juggling, you know. And it was like, and I was like, what the hell? What the geez? I was so, you know, and I thought about it and I realized what happened was that I didn't feel like being funny.
Yeah.
Didn't, you know, I walked on stage with no sense of humor, game over, right? You know, and I didn't know that could happen. And I realized from that one, always watch out for that. So, you know, as the other end of this, you know, because sometimes the audience can't go there with you, but if you walked out with no sense of humor, and there've been times, you know, when you go, geez, it's not their fault. I don't want to be here. Right now, you know?
Yeah.
And I just do my old hippie thing. Love the audience. That's all I just say. Love the audience. That's the ethics, right? And it straightens me out, you know, because it's just like, yeah, but what about them? They do want to be here.
Right. Know? Yeah. And I agree with that. Like I worked with Andy Kindler years ago in Florida. You know, Andy. You know, and just a brilliant comedian. And he did 8 shows down in Tampa. And for the shows, he got a standing ovation. And for the shows, he got over 25 people walk out each show.
Yeah, yeah, he'll walk a house.
You know, and I'm like, but I knew it when he walked in the door, which one he was going to get. It was him. It was not the audience.
That's so interesting. Yeah, it was when he was able to channel that that thing in him, that gift that he has.
Yeah.
When he was able to channel it to where it was just universally funny, was sort of the anger side of it sort of filtered out.
Yeah.
He's one of the funniest people in person that I've ever sat at a table with. You know, just delightful, just so up,
yeah.
You know, as a person. I was at a party with him once. I was at my house, but and Andy's talking, and he's talking about the worst show he'd ever done, which was at that time. Who knows? I'm sure he's topped it since then. At that time, was at the Kilkenny Festival in Ireland. You know, he goes, worst show I've ever done in my entire career. And I said, and I was trying to be, I said just generically, not knowing Andy, being about Andy, I said, you know, the worst show is to some extent an achievement also, you know. it certainly, right?
Yeah.
Started laughing because he thought I meant for him to have the worst show out of so many shows where 25 or more had walked out.
Yeah, it's fascinating how much you can learn by watching stand-ups over and over do the same show, the same guys going up, and you can see what, you know, where the magic is and where it isn't. And like with Andy, it was just that last 10% of him, that last energy of when he's in the moment and connected, and it's just magic when it's there. And when it's just the volume's down on it a little bit, people are like, I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. He can't. Yeah. You have to, it's so interesting because his whole thing is based on from what you're telling me, is just based on how comfortable he is on the stage within his own skin that particular night.
Yeah. When he would do, I remember he hit on a joke that week. He's like, Hey folks, you know, he has such great saves for when he's dying. And he's like, hey folks, like, the club just told me they have a new special. It's the Andy Kindler sandwich. It's not very good, but you get to eat it for 45 minutes.
Oh, chink. And I'm he's like, such a rim shot comic.
Yeah.
Well, I saw him up in Montreal doing his state of the, state of the industry thing 1 year. And he did a Karnak bit. Okay. He put the envelope to his head and he goes, and you kids are going to have to, I don't know how old, I don't know who's watching. You know, so, and he goes, Jay Leno, Jay Leno, Jay Leno. Pops it, and it pulls it out. Name 3 reasons that tonight's show's not funny anymore. It was pretty, he had a thing, he had a hard on for Jay, didn't he?
Well, and that, you know, that State of the Union speech.
He was never going to do that show anyway.
Our state of the industry speech that he did every year was to me fascinating again, because rhetoric comes from a speech background, right? This idea of traditional speech making in order to, you know, cause effects in the world in a broad way. And stand-up does this kind of myopic, you know, I'm just doing entertainment over here. And he forced those things together in this very intense, very on the nose, you know, criticism of an industry, but kept it so funny. Like he just merged those things. And that's really impressive.
Well, but at the same extent, it's like the correspondence dinner at one, you know, mm-hmm. used to be, you know, which is a tradition that I always thought, don't do this. You're not supposed to be, you know, hey, we're laughing and you're the president, and, you know, ha ha ha. They're supposed to be, you know, I mean, Chinese walls are cheap, but at least, you know, put a,
yeah, yeah, something. Yeah,
it's inappropriate. And now, what have we ever been better joke writers than, you know? I mean, Obama. Yeah, he could tell a joke, and he had great fucking writers too. You know, yeah.
That stuff's so thin about whether it's going to work or not. You know, it's so easy to go over the line with it that it really does take, you know, great writers and great delivery and everything else. And it is. It's
but if you're Andy Kindler, you're up there slagging an industry. But if you're Andy Kindler, you're up there slagging an industry that's in the room, you know, ha, 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 you know, you're not actually having any, it's all in fun. In other words, you're not changing anything about the way the industry is, you know.
Yeah, other than your ability to work.
Yeah. You know, so at some point, the idea of, I mean, at that point, you're, it's, there's a little court gesturliness to it, isn't there?
Gesturely? Yeah, for sure. I don't think like the court jester doesn't really even translate anymore. Like, can you imagine a corporate court jester? Like every major corporation board meeting has a jester there that actually gets to say what everybody's thinking. Cause that's all Shakespeare's fools were, was the ones who actually got to say it, you know? And like, they couldn't handle that. I mean, the function of that to keep, you know, power honest, or to keep, you know, everybody at least some kind of bridge between, you know, the people and power, it just doesn't really, it's not around anymore.
Well, and I think to a certain extent, the fact that everybody now has writers has a sort of, you know, leveled the playing field, meaning that it's made the, I mean, it's, I mean, comedy, this happened for me as a comedian. You just started thinking, well, especially when I stopped getting the chance to do the Tonight Show with Jay Leno, you know, when you know you're not going to get to talk to the 5 million people or whatever it was anymore, you know, and you're out there and you're thinking, at some point you just go, yeah, those are great jokes. And, you know, what's okay, the endorphins I get. I mean, in other words, you want something that's a little more high impact, or at least you think, wait a minute, if you want to see implementation, you want to see impact. You don't, I'm not saying anything about the art form. The art stuff's great. You know, you hang the picture on the wall, it's fantastic. It means something different to everybody who comes by. That's wonderful. It no longer belongs to you. I like the performance aspect. I mean, I understand all that energy, but as far as how to direct your intelligence towards something, you know, to try and actually affect change is a whole different thing, you know, in whatever way you think you might have the capability to do it, whether it's writing whether it's the monthly contribution to the local food bank, that's affecting change one way or another. It's keeping those homeless people from getting a job. Rimshot, please. Come on.
Sorry, you're cutting out a little bit. I think I lost you on that joke. Cutting on me a little bit.
Oh, okay. Hold on. Let me try and elevate this thing up. I don't even know where the microphones are on these laptops.
I don't think it's your mic. I think we just have a weak connection, sort of, is because you're freezing.
I've been having that problem.
So talk about that a little bit, because like, talk about the Bill of Rights thing, because, you know, that's a fascinating addition to like a stand-ups, you know, and an entertainer's resume, that you suddenly have a very specific type of activism. That's a very specific project. How did that all come about?
I got a good buddy, Josh Weinstein, also a good comedian, not the one who writes on, who wrote on for The Simpsons, the other Josh Weinstein, J. Elvis Weinstein. And Josh used to tell me, sometimes you better listen to friends, because they'll tell you things about you didn't see. And he goes, no, you get excited by ideas. That's what Josh told me. He says, you're comedy, you get excited by ideas. He says, it's cute. I get excited by ideas. Yeah. Well, I was doing material about the culture wars. I thought the culture wars were intentionally divisive. I thought for a large part it was phony. It was a fundraising, gig. Of taking people's heartfelt things and just twisting it around, you know, and I was upset about it, right? And I was trying to find it, after Judge Ray Moore of say you're 17, you're getting a little old for me, that Judge Ray Moore.
That guy.
Yeah. When he put you know that you're doing something wrong when you wait until 2 o'clock in the morning to do it. And he lifted that 10,000 pound copy of the Ten Commandments into the courthouse at like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
In Alabama, right? And that just upset me. It's like, you know, no offense, but you can make the stretch and say the Ten Commandments are the source of our laws, because they're one of the early laws, or the Code of Hammer. That is a stretch. But the source of our laws is the Constitution, you know? And when you start messing with your history that way, particularly about something like the source of your laws, the fundamental civic structure, you know, they rewrote history in the Soviet Union. It never ends well when you start messing with history. They tried to make the rivers run backwards in Siberia for socialist principles in the Soviet Union. A lot of people don't know this. Look at, I'm literally telling you the truth.
Really? As an engineering project?
As a project to demonstrate socialism. I mean, it was all this weird thing that got sold to Stalin, who you didn't want to get on the bad side of, you know? And people wonder why the Soviet Union had to import massive amounts of grain for decades. They ruined their agriculture by trying to make all these rivers in Siberia run backwards for hydroelectric plants. It was insane. But, you know, so you've got that whole rewriting history thing to the point of where they're not trying to rewrite biology, you know, or I guess what that's not biology, whatever that is, right? So I was thinking about this. I said, why do you have to do this? What is this other than, you know, I mean, shove this stuff. So the joke, so it started off as a joke where it was like, don't take the Ten Commandments down, just put rights up next to them and let people come and shop. And that's just, of course, you'd see the symmetry, 10 of one, 10 of the other. As a comic, you'd think that way. Yeah. I said, because, you know, the Bill of Rights tells me speak freely, carry a gun, pursue happiness, and then it presumes that I'm innocent. And my religion won't give me anything near that deal. So that was the joke, right? It's a throwaway joke.
Started as a joke. Literally,
it's just a thing. And then I started thinking, well, that's not a bad idea. I wonder how many Bill of Rights there are. So I Googled it, right? And all these listings came up, right? And I said, great, there's a lot of them. That's cool. And I clicked on one. There weren't any. Most of these listings were sarcastic. Here's a Bill of Rights monument. It's a 40-gallon drum with garbage thrown in it. That's what these pictures were of. This is what's happened to our rights, right?
Right.
So then I made I don't know if you ever heard yourself say these words to yourself, Dan French, Dr. Dan. Well, how hard can it be?
Yeah, that's a dangerous thought.
We'll build some monuments. This is how stupid I was, Dan. I originally thought the way to do this was totally the way that you'd ever fundraise before, maximum contribution of $100. You can't give more. That's how unrealistic I am in my worldview. That went away pretty quickly. But that was the original, you know, airy, this is poetry.
Thing. Yeah. And then when creatives get involved in the business plan.
Yeah. And then I mentioned the idea to, I just left us on some radio show. I mentioned the idea of this woman that I was on the show with, who was first time legislator in Arizona. She said, well, I'll do that. I'll sponsor that bill. You know, that Kyrsten Sinema, she was Kyrsten Sinema then too. Do you know who she is?
Wasn't she the senator that was she running into blowback?
She's
this time
from Arizona.
Yeah, she became Pardon? A right-winger.
She became a what?
Is she a right winger? I can't remember.
No, Kyrsten's a Democrat.
Okay,
and she's interesting. She took oath on the Constitution, not on the Bible. And I believe that Kyrsten, even you'll never read this anywhere, which just shows how much she's transcended this, because it was in the early. She never tried to hide. She's the only openly bisexual member of Congress. Okay. And she's an interesting person. She stayed with this project way longer than she had to. So I have a lot of respect for Kyrsten Sinema's story. Also, I may not agree with her politics in the Democrat. I don't know anything about that, but I know the human being, and the human being is pretty good for her word, you know? So Kyrsten's interesting. And the joke that I didn't ever do this as a joke. I did an interview and I saw it in press. I said, that's interesting. I said, and what's more impressive than her being openly bisexual, she's actually openly bipartisan, you know, which she is. She's always been that person. But Kyrsten went on, and I went to meet her in the legislature, first term state legislator in the House. And she said, Chris, you know, I love this idea, but if you haven't, we don't exactly run things around here. It's like supermajority Republican state, right? She said, I think if you really want to get this done, you should take it to the other side. And I said, Kyrsten, that's ridiculous. This is the Bill of Rights. So you take it to the other side. You find one Republican co-sponsor, and I bet, and who's going to vote against it? We're not asking for state money. It's private. You know, it's to just find one, you know, and do it. I'm not taking it to the other side, you know? So she found this very far right senator that she happened to like, named Karen Johnson. They sponsored this bill to authorize a Bill of Rights monument on the Arizona Capitol grounds, right? Nobody had ever seen their two names on a piece of legislation before, you know, but they were people, but they liked each other. So the template was being written before my very eyes, right? We almost got caught up in some stupid, anyway, budget thing by somebody who didn't like Kirsten, didn't want her name on the legislation, blah, 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 blah. Unanimously passed, right? Then Sinema stayed with it for 4 years afterwards, while she was still in the state legislature, because we couldn't get a proper site. They have this monument park where everything is a, you know, a trapezoidal shaped plot that they're grave plots.
Okay.
I'm not putting the Bill of Rights in the same
graveyard,
thing
as, yeah,
as the first police dog shot in the line of duty. I'm not, I just, I love dogs. And I don't think we should defund the canine unit either. But so she stayed with it. She made a lot of friends in the state capitol by then. She got us to walk around on the in this monument park. They gave us this incredible site that no one even knew was available. And we put up a Bill of Rights monument with a huge help from the comedy community. A big concert in Arizona raised a quarter of the money for it. It's been tough sledding since then. We've got an active project that's well down the road. People can go to Bill of Rights Monument Project.org to see it, to see what we're up to and what we're trying to do. We're trying to do it all 50 capitals. It's a critical mass project. You know, I think we need three, and then people start coming to us, because then it's a thing and they can see, oh, each one of these is different depending on the location, and we get to do our own design, and it's locally run, and it's not cookie cutter stuff. And, you know, and then you start getting the whole idea of, I don't know how many million school children collectively in this country visit their state capital every year. I know it's well over a million.
Oh yeah, easily.
You put up monuments that are going to be there, all 50 state capitals. They're monument grade. They're built to last literally 100 years, you know, made of century materials. You know, that's 100 million school kids being exposed to this thing in monumental form, in iconic form, in archetypal form, architecturally, the archetype of a monument. They're not all going to embrace it, but they're all going to have a different awareness of the structure. It's only 500 words. You can actually put it into monuments with that Constitution, making a monument to the, there's a Constitution, you know, the place in museum, the, in Philadelphia, the Constitution Center. The Constitution needs a center. You know, Bill of Rights, 500 words, read it in its original English. You know? Although we did propose that they have a bilingual component in the Arizona monument, because somebody requested, I had to miss that meeting. I'm glad, because the comedian, he wanted to say, look, people, I understand why we shouldn't have this in Spanish. On the other hand, those people are going to be a majority pretty soon out here. And it'd be nice if they understood our rights when that happens.
That's good point.
But that's the comedian, side of a mountain. I'll tell you what, nonprofit work is bad for your sense of humor.
Yeah, you know, the whole serious world, you know, the whole crisis world and drama and trauma and seriousness, like one of my sort of pet projects, I like to create nonprofits too. Typically they stay mythical, but I have Convert One Conservative, and that's kind of my sort of you know, inroads into the right program. But the one I want to do for comedians is Comedian Americans. Because comedians are the most oppressed group around. Like, we can't even talk the way we normally talk, or we get fired, we get beat up, we get thrown out. The serious are incredibly oppressive to the comedians. Like, they let us get on stage a little bit, and then they want to shut us up again.
You know, I was wondering, it's very funny to me, because I like all of this stuff winds when you start looking at it and see the elements of it that where you can see the seeds of how this became, this one thing became this other thing. But cancel culture comes from, I mean, what we now call cancel culture, which is a little bit different. It comes from, it's actually sort of the merger of fascism and comedy somehow. You know, I mean, it's this, you know, comedy like, or not, merger's not right, but there's, so comedy just all of a sudden opened up this, the Pandora's box of anything goes. All right. Which I personally think is the shortest route to the greatest good for the largest number. Freedom.
Freedom. You know? Okay. All right.
And if you can't speak freely, pretty soon you're not thinking clearly because you're not letting this evolve. You know, if you're restricted in self-censorship is fine. It's valuable. You know, you can't always, but I'm dead serious with that. I've had super funny thoughts in conversation that I went, no, you can't.
Yeah, but see that. That's really, oppression.
Even in a room. That's self-censorship. That's just respect for the feelings of others.
But that's my point. Like,
I'm not talking to the professional.
Like you can't take two comedians to a civilian's party. You can't have two comics together actually playing off each other because then that self-censor goes away. And civilians can't handle like a full-on stand-up mind and sensibility. Like, it's just too far for them too fast. So they repress it. So
yeah, you call them civilians. I have a buddy who's an avant-garde artist, and he says, you know, and he refers to them, and there's no way to make it sound like it isn't hierarchical, but he calls them the normals. And I understand what he means. You know, there's a great, why did his name just, come on, famous English satirist, come on.
Oh, Jonathan... Dunn or Locke, John Locke, or
no. Swift? Oscar Wilde. Sorry, Oscar Wilde. I was going to Swift, it was in my head and I couldn't get it out. I clearly communicated it to you. Oscar Wilde has a wonderful quote about the only people he wishes to know are artists and those who understand suffering, those who know beauty and those who know suffering. Anyone else, it's hard for me to talk to. I mean, basically. And the suffering part is the other part of the equation that from our discussion, it's sort of missing there. It's not so much, I think it's like, it's not so much as you don't want to take the comedians to the party. It's that it's very difficult to be in people whom it's difficult to communicate to people who don't have that, you know, that empathetic, that recognition of suffering of others, not in a drama, but I mean, just sort of that's one of the layers of all the communication is the awareness of the, you know. So, you know, but I don't think comedians are oppressed. I think the culture's gotten oppressive, you know, as to, you know, that's not funny. Well, Limbaugh wasn't funny and he was doing stand-up all the time. He did tremendous damage to comedy and, you know, and there was, the San Francisco school board needs to lighten the fuck up. You know, they were going to destroy a murals in this George Washington school that's undoubtedly been renamed. I'm fine. Name your schools whatever you want. Personally, I don't think we should be naming things after famous people anyway. I just don't like, I mean, I had a friend made this point. I extrapolated from the point of when our currency used to be beautiful. Our currency used to be beautiful. Look, when it had walking liberty on it. How about we celebrate that beauty and liberty? How about we celebrate that in our and in our buildings and things instead of just something that's named after the congressman that got the money for you to do the post office? You know, when you start naming bridges after the people that got the funding for it, it's just wrong. You know, you want to name the cancer wing after the millionaire? Fine, go ahead. But public stuff? No. I think it just is a kind of, you know, soft corruption, I believe is what they call that.
Yeah, I would say that's probably soft corruption, but it's also a political reality. It's a lot easier to get them behind it if they know their name's going to appear on it. You know, like if your Bill of Rights was the, you know, Joe Biden Bill of Rights project.
Well, that's one thing that we set out right at the beginning. And fortunately, back on something like this, but I said, look, we're not putting logos up here. You're not going to get on-site recognition of donors. It's not going to happen. In some states, it's legal. In some states, you can't do it anyway. But I said, we're not putting donor recognition on. You're not going to logo the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is the logo. You know, it's the brand, all right? That's the idea. You're not Coca-Cola. It's not the Coca-Cola bill, not to pick on Coca-Cola, although they were just in the news about something pretty retarded recently, speaking about left-wing oppression of language. Did you see the thing about their training stuff? Their human rights training?
No.
Where they actually, somebody leaked some of the slides and some of it is, and if you're white, try not to be so white. And it's like, clearly you don't understand white people. We're not trying to be white. We just can't help it. You know, don't make us think about that.
Once you split that stuff out into the broader public, like I've done a lot of this. So one of the things in rhetoric is there's a 2,500 year history of apologia in rhetoric. Like, how do you properly apologize so that you can be forgiven and move on? And you see guys like from the Me Too movement, like Louis C.K. was the big example, who did his own apology. And I'm like, dude, you are now way outside your realm of experience and you need a sophisticated message. And you did not just do it. You probably cost yourself, I don't know, $100 million, $200 million with a bad apology. So there's a certain level of
sophistication. Yeah, it was not Tylenol. It was not the textbook of how to get over a scandal.
You know, it's like if you're going to walk out off the stage and start talking to the broader culture about important things, you're out of your realm, dude. This is not that's not what you want to take on by yourself. That's when you need something like, you know, a rhetorician or actual rhetorical tradition. So you get some guidance. And like you're thinking about the goal of
serious,
rights.
I mean, that's a very specific psychological affliction emotional affliction that he has. He's not the only person that has this.
He could have used that.
You know,
he could have used some psychological cover, right? Some psychoanalytic.
But I mean, actually gone in and figured out by the roots.
Yeah.
You know, he's a super smart guy. And when I say pulled it out by the roots, probably not the best thing to be saying that he should reach in and pull it out by the roots. That probably wasn't the best use of rhetoric or metaphor or the way. I didn't mean it as a metaphor. I did mean it as a metaphor, but not anyway.
Not that metaphor.
You see how hard this stuff is? Metaphor. I need some rhetorical help.
You wanted a limited metaphor.
I need to pull that metaphor out by the roots.
I just see, like, you know, like you talk about cancel culture and all this stuff. I have a 21-year-old daughter who's super sensitive about language, and she does makeup and professional makeup. So she's done a lot of stuff in the trans community and with drag queens, and so she's super involved in that, super sensitized to it. And then, you know, she's trying to teach me all the different language adaptations. And I'm like, language is not built like that. You don't make artificial adaptations to organic.
You can try,
language.
But they won't stick.
They can't. You can't use that unless it has a type of organicness to it. If it's unwieldy and, you know, people can't use it, it won't catch on. That's not what language does.
I can't be they. I don't, that's foreign to me. I don't understand why you get to be they and I have to be just singular.
Yeah, it's just clumsiness. The language isn't built for it.
Although if you take it, I mean, I don't have a need to do a bit like this, but the bit is just hanging there to take, you know, I want to be they, I want to be that. I mean, just take any love song, you know, and just put they in front of all the, you know,
well, even your project, like calling it the Bill of Rights, I'm not even sure people know that's part of the Constitution. You know, I don't even think they understand that that's cut out.
No, and that's the whole reason that was the other thing it pays to advertise. The other thing of it was, geez, they don't teach it in the schools anymore. Most people don't even know what it is. It's a highly accessible document. And really, there's 10 amendments, but there's only like, you know, maybe 8.5. The Third Amendment, you don't really, you know, the Third Amendment they changed to. No quartering of soldiers except in Trump properties that got put in there just before. I think that was put in there on January 5th.
But they also jam a lot into each one of those amendments. I mean, there's multiple.
Yeah. And it's not hard to, I mean, you know, when you start grasping that it's actually an architecture with a centralizing principle, the centralizing principle being that, or insight or whatever you want to call it, that concentrations of power are what's inherently abusive to individual liberty. So if individual liberty is your goal, you need to create a system, checks and balances, accountability, transparency, so that too much power can't get concentrated because power tends to concentrate. That's its nature, and it's the nature of the people who seek it, right? So it's with so they tried to design. This is my view on this anyway. I'm not a constitutional, but when I look at the words and I look at the ideas and thoughts and the way I assemble it, the way it comes to me is, so the idea here is to liberate the best aspects of human nature, which are the creativity and the social, you know, all that kind of stuff, and inhibit the worst, which is the drive for power and dominion over others, you know, and you do it in a system, you know, I mean, it works as a system, you know, and it's a pretty good design. It's a nice design, because if you realize, well, the problem here is too much power in any one group of hands, and it's not, it can be military power, it can be economic power. We're getting some problems with that right now. You know, certainly religious power, certainly, and political power. And of course they all, you know, but what are the, show me a problem in the society today that isn't some manifestation of too much power in too few hands. Other than, I mean, you can say diseases, I guess, you know, COVID, you know, but if you know what I mean, a long-term, and so it's become this lens that I look at things through, right? Is I just put the power lens on and I go, oh, I get it.
Yeah. And I think that's completely viable. Like, do you have like a Hamilton? Like, Hamilton is the only American history that, you know, kids learn these days, you know, like
I've never seen it. I hear it's really good though.
I mean, oh, it's awesome. I mean, it's such a good blend of, you know, sort of modernity aesthetics, and like there's rap in it, there's everything in it that they recognize as entertainment, and it infuses enough history in there that, you know, you learn a little bit. It's fascinating to watch.
And the other, and I've seen Miranda in interviews, and he's like, well, I like this guy, you know. But you reminded me of one other thing that somebody told me in Arizona. So this Arizona project, it wasn't like this perfect. You never get perfect projects. It's like the viral video. You don't get that performance. It happens from a whole confluence of things. And right. Everything came around to make this magic project in Arizona. All right. And one of the magic things was that a high school history teacher in Nogales, Arizona, which is just across from Nogales, Mexico, three quarters of his students being Spanish speakers as their first language, you know, and not having much English over in the homes. He's the one that asked about the Spanish, you know, component. Okay. And everything. And he had his kids read the Bill of Rights for me on video in both English and Spanish, which I thought was, oh, this is fantastic. I love this. But he told me his insight was that he said, you know, the Bill of Rights, when it was written, the principles, the liberties were only accessible to maybe 5% of the people inside the United States. You know, 5% of the human beings living inside the borders of what was then the United States when it was ratified. Weren't accessible to women, to slaves, to certainly not to Native Americans, even to white men of under a certain property and wealth, right? But the thing about it, if you look at the language in the Bill of Rights, there's not a single exclusionary phrase in there in those terms. It is written in universal language. And so we've caught up with the document. We haven't caught up all the way with the document because you never reach the ideal because it's a fucking ideal. It's not real. It doesn't exist. It's all in your mind, you know. But we now, people, these were radical ideas. In 1791, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, due process, presumption of innocence, which is inside the due process. The language isn't there, but it adds up to that.
Right.
You know, no fourth confession. People don't realize the Fifth Amendment, you can't testify against yourself. That is an anti-torture amendment. That's exactly why it was put there. They were torturing people and forcing confessions, you know? The Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, and excessive fines, by the way, you anti-corporate types. So there's this whole design in there around promoting, preserving, protecting individual liberty, and we've grown towards it, you know, by even the limited experience of liberty and through the wrench overarching tragedy of the Civil War, as one might note, you know, and fits and starts. And we didn't just grow toward organically. People stood up and went into the streets and said, fuck y'all, y'all. I want those too. You know, from I mean, whether it's women's suffrage and then you know, all the way up to Stonewall, right? And now the trans, all this stuff is just people going, hey, I am a child of God or he who you don't believe in, whichever it is. But I got the same rights as you legally, civilly, you know, it's a powerful idea. And the whole world has caught this infection, you know, to some degree.
It's a good offer. It's a strong offer.
Yeah. Again, and so the document itself, virally, hugely successful, not easy to achieve, not easy to make work on the ground, but something worth holding up and going, you know, for regardless of what the next generation of Americans looks like, I don't care. But, you know, I mean, you know, I can read the demographic trends. I know where we're headed. So what if the ideas are the ideas are the idea. If more countries were closer to a rights-based system on the ground and the prosperity that comes from rights, because it ain't the fucking other way around, you know, if the more they wouldn't be trying to come here if they had what we have.
Right.
You know, yeah, export exactly the ideas, right. Stand up for them, be an honest, you know, Daisy said to me once while I was doing this, and I'd been beating my head against, that's my wife, Daisy, beating my head against, well, I'm just miserable, you know. And she says, Chris, she's got an accent. I do a bad Daisy. She says, Chris, you're always saying we only teach by our example. I said, yeah. I said, look. She said, then you need to have more fun doing this, because right now you're miserable and nobody's going to follow that.
Good for Daisy.
Yeah, Daisy.
So have you ever written stand-up about that? Because one of the things I've done in the last 10 years especially, I stopped doing a lot of club stand-up. And I take ideas and I work them until I've got at least an hour of themed comedy around something. And I just use it to sell whatever, you know, like I have a 1-hour show about persuasion, like teaching you how to be persuasive. And I just take whatever I can rescue from there. And then I wrap it in stand-up so that there's, you know, maybe 10 ideas in there. And, you know, I just find like it's just a really interesting, again, merger of those things. That's a lot more fun than, you know, preaching and teaching.
You're just cross-platform with it. That's all you're doing. You're going, I wrote this for this and I could take it in and plug it
in. Yeah, that's right.
Many different streams and the social. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this is my own personal issue, but I've sort of, this is a tough one for me, but the thing that's happened in our country has made me wonder about the possibility, you know, it's made me feel the potential, the possibility for communication smaller than it's been in a long time. People are too, you know, I remember the good old days when you only wanted your parking validated. Personality and worldview. You know,
that's a great joke. That is an awesome joke.
Thanks. I just thought of it. I just put it together.
Yeah,
I'd been thinking around in my head, but now we have this whole thing of, and people like it. And you know, we've got dominant technologies that are both narcissistic. You know, in there, it's narcissism's built into the whole thing. So you've got this whole as soon as this whole thing of everybody's a star started getting out there in the universe, what was that, 30 40 years ago, I thought, this is not going to end well. This is really possibly end well, because they don't say everybody's a rocket scientist. I was trying to remember the word for what kind of, everybody's a physicist. They don't say everybody's a theoretical physicist. You know, no, you develop skills, and those skills you have, you know, and you don't get them just because you have a Facebook page. But now, of course, you do, because your Facebook page is the reality that you can't afford. You just put on your Facebook page. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. Production, message production has changed, and your access to what seem like public platforms has changed. They're all illusions, but it seems like a public platform.
But it's also such needle in a haystack, and everybody thinks that they're talking to the world, of which they are, but everybody also seems to think the world is listening, which it's not.
Yeah. Well, you that's know, always been my thing about the First Amendment. Like, yeah, you have the right to say whatever you want. I have the right to not hear it. Not even just ignore it, but not to actually know it exists.
know, Tommy Smothers has had some really good thoughts about that, which is that the, you know, freedom of speech without the right to be heard.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, exactly, he would know a little bit about that, but he wasn't just talking about him. He's just talking about who really has speech in this country. Who is it that's always coming at you? Now, we've sort of democratized that, but not in a meaningful way, because they've democratized it to get inside here so that when you're expressing yourself, ads are popping up all over your screen based on what this increasingly sophisticated algorithm is trying to persuade you. You know, Stan, you watched The Social Dilemma, didn't you?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah. I did not know that Stanford had a persuasive technologies lab. Of course they do.
Yeah.
You know,
they've been sciencing persuasion, you know, since the war, since Hitler, you know, like, oh, this Hitler guy convinced a lot of people to do some stuff. Maybe we should pay attention to how he did that.
Did you ever know Ron Schock? You must have worked with Ron.
Yeah, I knew Ron Schock. Yeah.
Ron had a great line. He's Joseph Goebbels, the father of modern advertising.
Oh my God. Schock's one of those guys. Like, I just, again, fascinated by like super talent in stand-up, just start to speak and everybody was mesmerized. Just
I
that
couldn't
voice.
Believe it either. I worked with him at Bally's here in Las Vegas once, and Ron walks out, I didn't work with him. I went to see him work. I wasn't working with him. And Ron walks out on stage and just this scrawny looking little guy, probably a cigarette in his hand. He walks out and he walks up to the microphone. He looks and he goes, "Glad to be here." And everybody falls out of their chairs. And I'm thinking, what is funny about "glad to be here"?
They're just some guys that are just in it. You know, they just embody it.
Just funny.
Yeah.
I've had that happen like 3 times in my career when I was just funny. I walked out on stage once at this gig I was doing in Reno, where you're there so they can clean up after the elephants. I'm not kidding. In Sparks, Utah, they had an elephant acted up, and then you'd walk out and then they would clean up after the elephants and set up Tony Orlando and Dawn. Okay. And you're out there doing your 15 minutes and I'm doing jokes about Bosnia or some shit. It's a long time ago. Right. You know, about, Bill Clinton, comparing it to the Monica Lewinsky thing, I think one of the lines was no real commitment, no exit strategy. Isn't it amazing that the first president from the make love, not war generation can't do either? You know, it was stupid. Right? But there's an 8-year-old kid sitting that front table down, you know, because I'm elevated. 8-year-old kid. He's laughing at every single joke at the right place. Okay. He can't possibly be understanding the comedy. I was funny that day. I had funny rhythm. Everything about me was funny. And the kid was receiving that. No filter, no getting that it was there.
Right.
So interesting to me, really interesting to me, because it's never happened since. It's like, oh, so this is what really funny people get to feel like.
Yeah, I've got friends like that. There's a guy in Tampa that I worked with for a long, long time ago named Paul Parsons. And he's about 5 feet tall and weighs 130 pounds. And we walk out in a blue mechanics jumpsuit and just stand there. And he looks like he's been kicked in the face by life every single day on the planet. And he just stand there and people just start to laugh. And he'd be like, what the fuck are you laughing at? And that was his opener. I'm like, yeah, you're in it, buddy. You're a comic character, whether you want to be or not.
Or just like Schock, organically, something funny about the person on something communicates, just, you know, that's a gift for a staff, you know. I always thought that it was the words that were funny. And I was like totally a verbatim comic when I walked on stage, because I thought, well, the idea is this is what's funny, you know. And so it was a long road for me to go, oh, no, it doesn't happen that way at all.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah, I'm a script guy too. Like, I mean, but it's just so much like when you write for like Jimmy Schubert or, you know,
well, that's different. If you're writing for an established voice, you know what you're writing for. Oh
my God. It's just a whole new gear. So much fun to, you know, put words in those guys' mouths, because it's going to have 3 times the impact that you said.
And I was never, I mean, I never, I would work on, I would, when I'm working at a club with people, I would, if they were interested, I'd go, you could try this, reorder this, do this, just because you know, because I was bored with my own shit. No, I don't know why, you know, just because if you see somebody with a spot, yeah, yeah. So this is good, you know, don't do this and do that, you know, because there's certain things that, you know, actually work. And I went through the early on when I was just really insecure comic who had nothing nice to say about anybody else. And then after a while, when you become secure and you're understanding what it is that you're doing, then if you see something in somebody, you can, you know, encourage that part. But I never write for other people. You know, and very few of my jokes ever got stolen either for whatever reason. They just don't. The one I know that got stolen was I had a really nice Ann Landers joke about, because it was true, it was from an Ann Landers column. The way that you can tell if you're addicted to sex, according to Ann, if you have to have sex three times a day, every day, more than. So apparently anything up to and including three times a day is just somewhere in the average range, right? Why, and you held Vixen, you, right? But more than three times a day, then you're addicted and should seek professional help. Well, I have news for Ann Landers. The only way I'll ever get sex more than three times in one day will be if I seek professional help. That was the joke. But that's a classic joke, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's classic joke structure.
Yeah, yeah.
So people took that joke. But they didn't take the Bosnia stuff. What the fuck's up with that? What's wrong with my Bosnia, chum?
Poor taste. They just have poor taste. There's no accounting for bad taste in the world. Well, I think you should write a stand-up 1 hour about the Bill of Rights. I want to hear it. I want to go to the show. Invite me to opening night where you're like selling, probably, you know, the Bill of Rights project.
I probably should do that. Yeah. I did have a one-man show about my brother and me, which is actually quite good, which I'm thinking about doing direct to camera and putting up in, you know, like seven chapters on the internet for my, I worked with an act in Minneapolis, had the greatest line. He said, I'm the Jesus of Twitter. I have 12 followers. That's me on social media, 12 followers. But it would be worth doing anyway, just for the exercise. You started comedy in 1987. I started comedy the same year.
Really?
Yeah. I heard that in one of your other podcasts you were talking. Only I started and stopped because that was the year that my brother was diagnosed and died from AIDS. Okay. And which I've always been okay with because it turns out he got it from a blood transfusion, which took place during anal intercourse, but that counts, doesn't it?
Hey.
But anyway, that was a joke I did at the time that I can't get anybody to laugh at. It's dark, but it's, you know, but it's still funny.
Yeah.
You know, because he was my
funny
brother.
Funny is funny.
But actually, so that year was when I started, and I ended up doing 3 months of a juggling show in Japan at the end of the year, came back after that 3 months and was like 10 times funnier than I'd been when I left. It was interesting for no good reason other than something had happened.
Yeah.
You know, and I had some money in the bank. I think that always helps. I don't know.
it's amazing how much more relaxed you are on stage.
Apparently Mickey Rourke is better off when he's spent all of his money. And needs to work, but you know, I like a little money left.
Those dramatic actors, they got to draw on that pain.
But the Bill of Rights thing's a decent idea. You know, somebody did that Constitution show on Broadway, which everybody wrote about was really good. It's HBO. A woman did this in the last 2 years. An immigrant American, a show about the Constitution. And she was a comic and everything, you know, and I thought, oh, this is great. People are interested in that and they could see humor in it. But I had a good friend of mine who's a producer, watched the you know, movie of the show. And he said, it's not, you know, I don't know if he's right or wrong, but I think the idea of doing something that makes it accessible is a strong idea, you know? So I'm not giving you co-producer credit.
No. I give out ideas for free.
One of us wrote that. You're being open source here, right? This is open source.
I'm just a font of other people's success. That's what I'm here for.
I do the same thing. I'm always trying to tell people what they would be best at. And, you know, I think it's best to save that creativity quite seriously. I mean, honestly, if you're a creative individual, turn that stuff inward, you know, because even from the standpoint of if you think your ideas deserve getting that, you know, productivity, getting the name that's, people will listen to you more if you're somebody other than you or me, right, Dan? You know, I mean, so success does gain you more credibility toward an audience. You and I might know everything in the world, but you know, people are going to go, well, you know, what are you doing? And you know, what have you done with all this font of knowledge? You know, and I go, well, you know, I built a monument and I...
Hey, come on, you, I had did a you build a monument?
I had a juggling video, you know. So, but it is good to, you know, more than likely, if you're a creative individual, your creativity is a limited resource and you should probably focus it initially on develop, on feed it back and make that the algorithm, you know, like those algorithms learn about us, you know, yeah. You got your own creativity, feed it back in and get that loop going where it grows.
Yeah. You know, that's funny.
I think that's a good idea.
For sure. Well, this, I'm having fun doing the podcast. I have all sorts
of great things
that I do. I really appreciate you jumping on and talking to me for, you know, hour and 15 minutes. I knew you'd be interesting and you are. I would love to encourage you to do that show. That's the limit of involvement.
It's just something I hadn't really thought about because it's so hard to actually do the monument work, but I need the creative thing. I actually think I want to do something personal because the idea stuff is one thing, but the thing I've never, other than, and my one man show, fabulously unsuccessful, unbelievable. Other than the opening night and the closing night, I don't think one night we had 18 people in a 99 seat Equity Raver House in LA. One night we had 18 people and 12 of them. And I wish I was making this up, were juvenile delinquents that were getting credit on community service by attending the show.
Nice.
And I'm talking about my brother die, you know, helping my brother die from AIDS, you know, and they're 18 year old, you know, people who, you know, sold pot to an undercover agent or some shit.
That's your people. That's your audience.
I tell you what, it was an interesting experience though, Dan. I was never afraid of silence on stage after that ever again. And as a comedian, comedians are terrified by silence.
Yeah, you know? That's totally true.
That's something that was so powerful about Andy Kaufman, not afraid of silence.
Oh my God, that guy, you know, he was one of the first artists of discomfort. You know, he made everybody feel that discomfort.
I think it's valuable thing to have in your comedy recipe if you can. You know, I'm not talking about jabbing an audience constantly, but knowing when, you know, knowing, I mean, you do certain kind of material, you have to push them to discomfort and then you pull them back in and then they can, then they're not uncomfortable with what, you know, I mean, it does work that way where you cross. I mean, I had a piece of material with something I was always happy with was it was about the epidemic of school shootings that was going on. The opening line is not funny. If you look at it on a piece of paper, you have to know where it's going. And if I ever pulled back from the opening line, the entire material collapsed. But if I had faith in where I was going and that it was coming from a place of truth inside of me and not mockery, you know, that I knew what I was talking about. And the opening line was, remember the good old days in this country when a troubled teenager would just kill himself.
I think I remember.
Now that's very harsh, but the topic isn't suicide, teen suicide. The topic is violence. Okay. And I know this in my head. I know where I'm going.
Right.
Okay. And the next line was, but of course now they've learned it isn't healthy when you hold those feelings inside.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing goes back out and finally it's about the level of violence in the society. You know, you can't ultimately, and it isn't in this material where it stopped being developed at the time I developed it. Ultimately, you can't be selling half the weapons on the planet and have a peaceful society at home. You can't. There's no way that you can, there's no way, you know?
Yeah, there's America has some mythology issues, some deep mythology issues about weapons and, you know,
violence. Well, we were selling 50% of the weapons 50 years ago in this country, and there wasn't anywhere near the weapons trade that there is in the world now. So that was not a necessity. That was a choice made by power that was fueled by powerful interests and money and everything. But when you start thinking about how many countries around the world that stuff saying made in America is being dropped on people, you start going, maybe,
Maybe.
You know, I heard some CIA agent talking about it once, ex-CIA agent, going, you know, when the rest of the world watches Star Wars, we're the Death Star?
Yeah.
And I went, holy fuck. And, you know, you go, I don't, you know, and I'm not saying, I can't, you know, matter of fact, you can't, now you can't run this podcast because this will ruin the Bill of Rights project if people, you know, I mean, this is why I love America, because of these ideas. And I think that, you know, ultimately, the closer we hew to these ideas, at some point you start going, okay, let's, maybe we should export the ideas, not the, I have an interim step between the bombs and the ideas, the Bill of Rights. I have an interim export, and it's basically, it's any anxiety drugs, because they're a lot cheaper than the weapons. And I was thinking, for example, for God's sake, the Middle East, those people, they need Xanax and Viagra. They need to chill the fuck out. And
yeah, there you go. I think, you know, that's one of the things I love about comedy. We come up with crazy solutions that you, when you step back, you go, you know what? That probably would help. You know,
I always, my facetious idea years ago was, and now of course the one's happening and the other isn't, but that's fine. Was, look, how about we do an experiment? We make guns illegal for 5 years, and we make dope legal for 5 years.
I think we lost you, Chris. I think we're out. I don't know if we reached our limit, but I think that is the end of the Chris Bliss Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We'll zip back around at some point. Head over to Rhetoric Warriors, take a persuasion course, come back and see us soon. Remember, great persuasion will change everything.